Broadcasting from the beautiful Hill Country in Texas, this is OneRadioNetwork.com.
Good morning. This is OneRadioNetwork.com. The telephone number is 888-663-6386. Email Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com. Here's your host, Patrick Timpone.
Well, good morning. I trust you're well. You look good. Let me see your tongue. That's it. Okay. You're doing pretty good. Pretty good. Well, we're going to have fun this morning. Stephen Gundry, MD, heart man. He has his second book out, New York Times bestseller, called The Plant Paradox. We're going to learn about what he has discovered over the years looking at hearts. He's done a lot of heart operations, I think 10,000 or so. Man. So this is going to be fun. He lives out in Palm Springs, California, where Frank used to live. Do you know, remember on the banks they used to say FDIC and FSLIC on the bank things? FSLIC, I found out from a monetary guy that means Frank Sinatra lives in Southern California. But I think he had too many martinis before he told me that. Yep. Next hour also, we're going to talk more about diet. There's a lady whose husband was like, he was like really sick, and she was sick, and she's a spiritual economist, and she used her study of PhD in economics to hone in on a diet that helped her husband and her get well. And so it's called the equilibrium diet. So we have a lot about food and diet and stuff this morning. If you'd like to be on the show, couple ways to do that. You can use the telephone that nobody does anymore. It's still got those little buttons, you know, you're going, yep, but I know it's can't use your thumb, so nobody does it. But it's 888-663-6386. Email Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com is the email, Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com. I wonder if those Neanderthals 300,000 years ago, or humanoids, you know, Homo sapiens, knew that they were going to do the opposing thumb thing doing texting 300,000 years ago. What do you think, Dr. Gundry? You think they knew about that, and that's why they're working their thumbs?
Well, they probably didn't know about that, but they had a brain that was actually 10,000 years ago, human brain was 15% bigger than it is today.
We got a shrinking brain?
Yeah, we do, unfortunately.
Dr. Stephen Gundry is a cardiologist, New York Times bestseller, 40-year career. He's performed 10,000 heart surgeries and developed the life-saving medical technology in his book, The Gundry's Diet Revolution, in 2008. And now he's got a new one out called The Plant Paradox, with, again, for 4 weeks now, New York Times bestseller. So we have a lot of questions for you. I saw a thing yesterday, Dr. Gundry, where there's an archaeologist and a big article that they claim that we humanoids, Homo sapiens, a couple, are 300,000 years ago that they found artifacts. Wow.
Right.
Is that possible? I guess it is.
Oh, yeah. You know, that was my research as an undergraduate at Yale. Uh-huh. Was human evolutionary biology.
Really? And really?
One of the interesting things, so I've kept a real interest in this, and there's the prevailing theory was that the final human form of Homo sapiens came out of Africa about 60,000 years ago. But there's no question that Homo sapiens within Africa dated back several hundred thousand years. And the interesting finding from yesterday's report was that everybody has pretty much assumed that Homo sapiens started in eastern Africa, possibly along the southern tip of Africa. But the findings of these Homo sapiens in Morocco, in western Africa, makes everybody kind of rethink just how far and fast we spread throughout Africa before we left Africa. So that's what the interesting finding that came out yesterday.
Right. So the 300,000 years to a fellow like you who studied this wasn't a big surprise for you?
No.
What do you suppose they were eating back then?
Well, we actually know pretty much what they were eating.
Really?
And we were all actually descended from tree-dwelling animals, the great apes. We share 99% of our genes with chimps and gorillas. And we ate a lot of leaves. And one of the things that actually made us uniquely human is we ate a lot of fish and shellfish. And it actually built a very big brain, which we can talk about at length if you want.
Sure.
But the other thing that really changed us into humans was the harnessing of fire. And the fascinating thing about fire is no animal actually has the ability to break down the cell wall of a plant that they eat. And a cow doesn't, a gorilla doesn't, a horse doesn't. But all animals, even as small as a termite, require bacteria in their guts to actually do that job. And that requires a lot of space for your fermentation vat. That's why it looks like gorillas are very fat, but that's just a giant fermentation vat in their belly. So the interesting thing about fire is that fire breaks down cell walls. So the prevailing theory of why we have kind of a small gut compared to a gorilla is that fire allowed us to kind of replace a lot of bacteria and do the job with cooking to break down plants. So we were able to cook tubers, like sweet potatoes, like yams, and get calories that no other animal was capable of doing. And it's actually a fascinating concept that we really owe our final step in evolution to barbecue.
Barbecue, yeah. like in Texas. We have a lot of barbecues here in Texas, yeah.
As anybody from Hill Country would know.
Yeah, well, you know about the Hill Country. Then.
Oh, absolutely.
Who doesn't, yeah. Well, but, you know, there's also conjecture, and, of course, we can't solve it here, that we were always separate from the apes, and because we knew that we knew. In other words, apes just know, but we know that we know.
Yeah.
Right. So I guess it doesn't matter. So do you think, though, that the human species really did evolve out of the great apes?
Well, we didn't necessarily evolve out of the great apes, but we know that our lineage separated from the great apes about 8 million years ago.
8 million?
8 million.
Whoa.
And interestingly enough, and I talk about this in the Plant Paradox,
do you?
That one of the things that separates us from the great apes, even though we share 99% of our genes, is a sugar molecule that lines our blood vessels that's different from the sugar molecule that lines great ape blood vessels and actually most other animals. And the sugar molecule is called NU5AC, and I just tell people to kind of remember it as who knew. And it turns out that we share this sugar molecule with chickens and fish and elephants.
Really?
And we, cows and pigs and sheep, And great apes carry a different sugar molecule on their blood vessels, which is called NU5GC. And one of the fascinating theories of how it's possible that eating meat might cause heart disease and cancer comes from the study of NU5AC versus NU5GC. And long story short, because it's pretty boring, we make a antibody to NU5GC because it's foreign, and it looks so much like our sugar molecule, NU5AC, that we actually attack the lining of our blood vessels by mistake. And it's kind of like friendly fire in the military. And one of the interesting theories that I agree with is that the reason meat may be bad for us is that it contains this sugar molecule and makes us attack our own blood vessels, which is fascinating. The other thing that's fascinating is because fish and chicken don't have this sugar molecule, when we eat these things, we don't attack our blood vessels.
Well, good for us.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's really very curious, interesting. But one would think that if you have a couple million years of jumping on buffaloes and stuff and eating them and tigers and I don't know what we ate, that this, you know, something would change to adapt to that. Why doesn't seem logical that we carry this NU5AC for millions of years and not change with people eating red meat?
Well, there was no advantage to change because, quite frankly, as I talked about in my first book, Dr. Gundry's Diet Evolution, you're basically designed to grow up, have babies, and then get out of the way so that your babies have something to eat. And I like to tell folks that we're basically the solid fuel booster rockets on the space shuttle. And the space shuttle is our children. And after we get the space shuttle into orbit, after they grow up, the space shuttle doesn't say, boy, you booster rockets have been so great to me, I want you to enjoy orbit with me. No, they say, hey, thanks for the ride, but, you know, you're dead weight, and they're jettisoned and crash into the ocean. So there wasn't actually an advantage for us to live beyond our reproductive years. And in fact, it was a big disadvantage. So there's no genetic or biological impetus to have us live a long time.
But you say there was no advantage on the NU5AC. I mean, surely there are a lot more tigers and gazelle and giraffe and zebras and red meat things than there were chicken and fish running around. So there would be an advantage, wouldn't it, to have
because if you're talking about developing, say, coronary artery disease, you could eat all the gazelles and, you know, and big game that you wanted to, and you it wouldn't matter if you wanted to live to be 100. So there was no, you know, evolutionary pressure to change a molecule. It had no benefit to change it.
So I kind of lost you there. What do you mean? So you could still live to 100 eating a gazelle?
No, you wouldn't. That's the whole point.
Oh, but then, so wouldn't the species figure out, well, this is not good, we're just kind of croaking here at 60, and...
No, that's actually the plan.
Oh, that's okay, that's the evolutionary thing.
Right, in other words, you're no good. In fact, you're a drain on the system, because there's only so much food to go around. And so to live a long time is actually against evolutionary principles. Now, you can bend those principles, and that was the purpose of actually both of these books. If you actually demonstrate to your monitoring system, to your genes, that you're not taking your fair share of food, and that you're actually contributing to work. Used to have this discussion with Jack LaLanne.
Huh. I knew Jack. Yeah, he was cool.
Yeah.
What a guy.
If you look at super long-lived people, one of the things that's interesting about them is they tend to lose weight after adulthood. And when they're in their 90s and 100s, they tend to weigh what they used to weigh when they were 13 years of age. And so Jack and I were, and so you generally lose muscle mass. And Jack and I were talking one day, and he says, well, what if when I'm 85, which he was at that point, I had the muscle mass that I had when I was a young man, what would that say to my genes? And I said, and I'll say it again, so if you have the muscle mass at 85 of a 30-year-old, that means that you are still wrestling saber-toothed tigers, or you are still hauling a side of buffalo back to camp, and so you're actually useful to keep around. And so you would predict that carrying muscle mass into old age would be a very good thing to do. And study after study shows that strength training, as we get older, absolutely increases longevity. And so so Jack was right about that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I saw him right before he translated, and he was very frail kind of looking almost. Yeah, it was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so let's dig into the heart thing. 10,000 heart surgeries. So is it, can I theorize then that most these things were all, you go in, doc, with atherosclerosis and do something to clear out the arteries with the stents and whatever all the stuff you guys do? Is that what most of your surgeries are about?
Well,
or bypasses and
yeah, I was
like
chairman
that.
Of cardiothoracic surgery at Loma Linda University for many years, and I and my partner Leonard Bailey did almost all of the pediatric and infant heart transplants. We've still done the most of any two people in the world, and was also famous for operating on people who nobody else wanted to operate on, and that's actually what changed my career back in 1997. I was referred a young man, 48 years old, from Miami, Florida, who I call Big Ed in the first book, and Big Ed makes a reappearance in The Plant Paradox. And he was a big, big guy, 248 pounds when I met him. Sorry, 265 pounds. And he had been diagnosed with inoperable coronary artery disease. He had so much crud in his blood vessels that you couldn't put stents in them. You couldn't do bypasses because there wasn't any place to jump the graft to. And he'd gone around to all the centers, like the Mayo Clinic, like Cleveland Clinic, like Stanford. And I was usually kind of the last stop on this tour. And everywhere he went, he was turned down correctly. And he got to me about 6 months into his journey, and I looked at his angiogram, the movie of his heart, and I said, you know, Big Ed, I agree with everybody else. There's nothing we're going to be able to do for you.
Hmm.
He says, well, yeah, but here's the deal. For the last 6 months, I've been on a diet, and I lost 45 pounds, and I went to a health food store, and I bought all these supplements, and he had actually brought in a big shopping bag full of supplements. And he said, maybe I did something in my blood vessels. And I'm going, well, you know, good for you for losing weight, but it's not going to do anything to your blood vessels. And I know what you did with all those supplements. You made expensive urine. And I used to say that.
I know. A lot of docs still say that today.
Yep. Most of them still do. So he said, well, you know, come on, why don't we do another angiogram? Why don't you humor me? I've come all this way. So I said, you know, okay. So we did. And this guy in 6 months' time had cleaned out half the blockages in his coronary arteries.
Because you could see the previous test.
Right, because, you know, there I am, I'm looking at the old one and I'm comparing it to the brand new one, and I go, so it's funny, I put on my surgeon hat and said, wow, you know, this is great.
This is cool.
Yeah, now there's places to put new blood vessels. So if I knew what I know now, I'd say, wow, this is great, let's keep doing this. Whatever you're doing, but no, I operated on him, uh-huh. and I actually did a 5-vessel bypass,
yeah. And
he did fine. But after we were done, I said, you know, tell me about this diet you went on, and let me look at those supplements. So when he starts describing his diet, I said, wait a minute, you know, time out here. You know, I had this crazy major at Yale on human evolutionary biology, where I defended a thesis that you could take a great ape, manipulate its food supply, manipulate its environment, and prove that a human would be the result. And I actually successfully defended my thesis. And I said, wait a minute, this diet you're talking about is what my thesis was all about. And I called my folks down in San Diego and said, hey, do you still have my thesis? And they said, yeah, it's here in the shrine, all 175 pages of it. And I said, well, send it up. And I actually am in my office, and I'm looking at my thesis. It's in my cabinet. So I was a big, fat guy, and I was running 30 miles a week, going to the gym 1 hour a day, eating a healthy, low-fat, Adventist vegetarian diet, and thinking I was doing everything right. But I had horrible arthritis, I had high blood pressure, I had prediabetes, I had migraine headaches, and I had done everything right, and why was this happening to me? So I put myself on the diet and lost 50 pounds my first year, and I subsequently lost another 20 pounds, and I've kept it off for 17 odd years. And then I looked at his supplements, and I said, son of a gun, a lot of these supplements that he was taking, I was using down in the laboratory to resuscitate dead hearts that had been dead for over an hour.
Really?
And then transplanting them. And I was putting these supplements down the arteries and veins of the hearts, and it never occurred to me to swallow the dumb things. So I started swallowing a bunch of supplements.
What kind of things did you start taking?
Well, it's interesting. He was taking alpha-lipoic acid.
Sure.
He was taking coenzyme Q10. He was taking grapeseed extract.
Mm-hmm.
And he was taking actually a lot of fish oil.
Mm-hmm.
And he was taking some cinnamon and chromium and some selenium. And so I started sending my blood work up to the University of California at Berkeley, which then became Berkeley Heart Labs. And, you know, within a few months, my cholesterol numbers had normalized, my blood pressure was normal, my prediabetes was gone. But remarkably, my arthritis went away, and I stopped having migraine headaches. So I started putting the patients I operated on this program. I put all my staff on it. And after about a year of doing this on what my wife calls Black Friday, I looked in the mirror before I went to work and I said, you know, I can't keep doing what I'm doing, because I can pretty much teach people how to eat, and they can reverse heart disease, they can reverse diabetes, they can reverse arthritis. And, you know, I shouldn't operate on them. So I resigned my position and came out to Palm Springs, where I set up an institute and just kind of opened the door and invited people to come in and play, with the proviso that they were each my research project, that every 3 months we'd send about 10 tubes of blood around the country and look at the effects of food choices and supplements. And I've published a bunch of papers at the American Heart Association about my work, and at the European Atherosclerosis Society, just to name a couple. And the initial results resulted in my first book, And then after that first book came out, a lot of people with autoimmune disease started showing up at my door. And they said, what do you know about autoimmune disease? And I said, well, I don't know much about autoimmune disease, but I know a whole lot about the immune system because I'm a transplant immunologist, and I'm very famous for fooling the immune system so that I could put a pig heart in a baboon and have it live for a month. And that's actually a very long time. The previous record was 5 hours. So I said, let's find out what the immune system's looking for. And that actually brings us back to what started our discussion about that sugar molecule, NU5GC. One of the frustrating things about trying to put a pig in someone like us is that the pig has the wrong sugar molecule on their blood vessels, and we attack it. So, but that's what I've been doing for the last 17 years now, and that research is now in the plant paradox.
And so you're helping people without cracking their chest or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. I figure if I can teach somebody how to clean out their blood vessels without me doing it,
sure,
they'd probably like that.
Yeah, I'm sure. Dr. Stephen Gundry, renowned cardiologist, over 10,000 heart surgeries. But let's see. So we have been told often over the last 20 years, 30, when I've been studying this stuff, Doc, is that much of the reasons why the heart gets clogged up is too many complex carbohydrates could be one of the ideas. The insulin gets way high, damages the blood vessels. Cholesterol comes in, patches it up. Calcium comes in, slaps it on to make it smooth. And it clogs up things if you keep doing that. I think it's called metabolic syndrome. More carbs issues rather than animals. What do you think about that theory?
Yeah, one of the things that we try to convince people that simple carbohydrates, which unfortunately characterizes the Western diet, is very, very, very different from complex carbohydrates, which I call resistant starches. These are sugar molecules that are resistant to digestion by us, but the bugs that live in our gut think they're the best thing that ever happened to them. And these are called, in certain circles, prebiotics. Most people have heard of probiotics. Those are the friendly bacteria. But what most people don't know is that these probiotics, these friendly bacteria, have to be fed the things they like, basically fertilized properly. And if you don't give these friendly bacteria what they need to eat, then they actually don't grow, they die. And what I call the bad bugs basically take over. And interestingly enough, we now know there are essentially two sets of bugs that live in our gut. There's over 10,000 different species. But the obesogenic bugs, and they really are, love simple sugars, and they love saturated fats. On the other hand, the good bugs love resistant starches, love tubers, love leaves, and they can't live on sugars and saturated fats. So just today, there was a study published out of Calgary, Canada, of taking obese school children and doing what's called a double-blind placebo-controlled trial of giving half the kids prebiotics dissolved in a glass of water. This is friendly food for good bugs. And the other half of the kids got the exact same looking stuff that had no prebiotics in it. And they were shocked to see that the kids who got the prebiotics, in other words, friendly gut food, actually lost significant amount of weight, while the kids who didn't get it continued to gain significant amounts of weight. In fact, three times as much as the kids who got the prebiotic. And they also found, like I write about in The Plant Paradox, that the bugs in the gut changed. And they changed from, in the kids who got the prebiotics, to friendly bugs. And the kids who didn't get the prebiotics still had these obesogenic bugs in them. And it's what I talk about in the book, that the key to good health, and actually the key to preventing heart disease, lies in your gut and the food you feed your bacteria. And so it's not that we're, you know, making cholesterol that plugs right. our arteries. Right. Long ago, the very famous Texan heart surgeon Michael DeBakey said that he was convinced that cholesterol had nothing to do with heart disease, that it was merely an innocent bystander.
Yeah.
And it was actually there to kind of pick up the pieces. There's an expression that if an alien was sent to Earth to study us, one thing that he could say is that every time there was an accident on the freeway, he always saw an ambulance. And you could, because you always saw an ambulance at the scene of an accident and didn't know what an ambulance was, you might assume correctly as an observation that the ambulance caused the accident. And so many of us working in cholesterol and heart disease agree with Michael DeBakey that, in fact, cholesterol was the ambulance, and it was there to pick up the pieces of the accident.
Not the perpetrator.
Not the perpetrator.
All right, right. Okay, I got a lot to go here talk about. We're not going to even do any commercials because I'm having too much fun. Okay, so these prebiotics, just simply, what kind of foods are these are prebiotics?
Yeah, so prebiotics are the tubers, for instance, sweet potatoes, yams, jicama, mm-hmm. Green bananas, plantains. There's, believe it or not, there's two grains that are prebiotics, sorghum and millet.
Really?
Yeah.
Millet. How be done?
Millet. Millet is a fascinating ancient grain of Africa, and quite frankly, that's where we all came from. That there's been some fascinating studies that Africans who eat millet actually have no heart disease. And one of the interesting theories about all this was that the prebiotics, the good fiber in millet, was one of the reasons. In fact, I'll tell you a fascinating story if you don't mind. We've been told that, you know, fiber is good for us. And that actually started with a British surgeon by the name of Dennis Burkett. And he went on a mission down to Africa. He was a colon surgeon. And when he got down to Africa, he couldn't find any colon cancer to operate on, which was a big disappointment. And he said, well, that's weird. You know, we have colon cancer all over the place in England. And he said, why don't these guys get colon cancer? So he started looking at their diet. And they were eating huge amounts of yams and sweet potatoes and a lot of leaves. And he became fascinated with their poops, with their bowel movements. And he'd actually go around photographing how big these bowel movements were. So he came up with the theory that the reason they didn't get colon cancer was that their bowel movements were huge, and it was all this fiber that they were eating in the tubers and yams. So he came back to England. And unfortunately, England didn't have a lot of tubers and yams, but they had a lot of grains and things like oatmeal and wheat in rye.
Sure.
And he said, well, there's fiber in these grains, and fiber is fiber, so we should be eating lots of grains to get fiber. Now, what he didn't know is that the fiber in grains is actually a fiber that's resistant to digestion. It's insoluble fiber, whereas the fiber that the Africans were eating was what's called soluble fiber that gut bugs can eat. And the irony of the story is he's the father of fiber, but he actually died of colon cancer.
Interesting.
So the American agricultural industry, which has a lot of insoluble fiber to sell, has used this excuse to convince people that fiber is fiber. And in fact, it's not. In fact, as I talk in the Plant Paradox, wheat germ agglutinin, which is a lectin in the insoluble fiber of wheat, is actually one of the best ways to produce atherosclerosis in an animal model. So I get a kick out of people sprinkling wheat germ on everything, because it's a really good way to create heart disease, not prevent it.
Yeah, we used to do wheat germ back in the hippie days in the 70s and 80s in the health food stores, right? Wheat germ. Yeah.
Yep, that's exactly
so,
right.
So what are the foods that people are eating, the carbs, the simple carbs that are causing the atherosclerosis? Would it be more like pasta, brown rice, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, it's not only pasta, but what's happened is we've gotten on a real sugar fix, and people have become convinced that fruit juice is really healthy for
sure.
them,
mm-hmm.
and unfortunately, it's just a big giant glass of sugar. And when I tell people to, you know, give fruit the boot and not eat fruit and to not drink juices, they look at me like, but everybody knows how good this is for you. And I say, well, you know, we're the only animal that drinks juice. And if you think juice is healthy, let's take a trip to the San Diego Zoo and look in all the cages and see if we can find a juicer. There aren't any. This is mainlining sugar. And unfortunately, we've become so addicted to sugar that an entire industry has grown up convincing us that artificially sweetened drinks are safe because they don't have any sugar. And in fact, every study shows that artificial sweeteners actually kill off good bacteria in our gut and promote the growth of bad bacteria. In fact, when I was a big fat guy, I was drinking 8 Diet Cokes a day and, you know, running 30 miles and going to the gym 1 hour a day and wondering why I'm a big fat guy.
Yeah.
And I was just killing off all my good bugs with my Diet Coke.
So the sugars, obviously the Cokes, but more of the complex cookies, cakes, crackers, pasta, I guess rices and...
rice is in there, and believe it or not, white rice is actually safer than brown rice.
It's easier to digest, isn't it?
Well, it's interesting that the hulls of grains contain these plant proteins that are called lectins, L-E-C-T-I-N-S. And lectins, as I show in the Plant Paradox, are the way plants defend themselves and their babies, their seeds, from being eaten by their predators, us, among other things. And they use these to actually make people sick. And you can actually show that eating lectin-rich foods promotes obesity and metabolic syndrome and prediabetes. And one of the amazing things in my tens of thousands of patients who we've studied is that when we take away these particular plant lectins from people, they not only lose weight, but their diabetes goes away, their prediabetes goes away each and every time.
Mm-hmm. How does the body like things like maybe wild rice, legumes, white potatoes, dairy?
Great question. So legumes, no human being ate a legume until 10,000 years ago when agriculture started. Beans and peas have so many lectins that the Center for Disease Control states that 20% of all food poisoning cases in the United States are caused by the lectins in undercooked beans. In fact, ricin, the white powder we send to our elected officials, is the lectin of the castor bean. A couple molecules of ricin will kill you. So beans are a real problem unless you pressure cook them. Pressure cooking destroys the lectins in beans.
It does.
Now, potatoes.
Yeah, potatoes.
Potatoes. Potatoes are a nightshade family.
All right.
And unfortunately, nightshades are from America. The nightshades are the potatoes, tomatoes, peppers, eggplant, and believe it or not, goji berries.
Goji berries.
Goji berries. And nightshades have some of the highest lectin content of any food. And what's amazing is none of us in America are from America. We're from Europe, Asia, or Africa. That means that none of us were exposed to an American plant like a potato until 500 years ago when Columbus started trade. And it's my contention and others that getting to know a new lectin in 500 years is speed dating an evolution, and I don't think it can be done. So if you're going to eat a potato, which I don't recommend, you need to pressure cook it. If you're going to eat a tomato, you've got to do what the Italians do, and the Italians always peel and de-seed their tomatoes before they make sauces. In fact, the peels and the seeds have the lectins. And my my grandmother on my mother's side was French, and she taught my mother to always peel and de-seed tomatoes before she served them. And in fact, she did that. And the first time I ever had a slice of tomato that had a peel and seed was when I went to Yale, and I thought it was the weirdest thing I'd ever had. And why would anyone do that? But traditional cultures have figured this out. For instance, the Native American Indians in the Southwest always char their chili peppers, peel them, and de-seed them before they grind them into chili powder or before they eat them. And in fact, you'll never open a can of green chilies and see peels and seeds because they've been removed. But we forget some of these basic principles. Same with quinoa. Quinoa is the new darling of healthy eating, but the Incas had three detoxification processes to get the lectins out of quinoa so it wouldn't kill them.
They figured it out.
Yeah, they figured it out. And we talk about a lovely young lady from Lima who moved to Los Angeles and who got horrible IBS intestinal problems. And it was because her mother had always pressure cooked quinoa and had told her that you cannot eat quinoa without pressure cooking. And she thought her mother was just an old wives' tale. So when she moved to the United States, she didn't pressure cook her quinoa. And she came out to me and I said, well, here's your problem. You're not pressure cooking your quinoa. And she said, you know, my mother flew up here from Lima 3 weeks ago and bought me a pressure cooker and said, you stupid girl. She said, you mean my mother was right? And I said, yeah, your mother was right. So, and she's been doing fine ever since she bought her pressure cooker.
Before you leave here, we're going to get you to go over very clearly what you believe is, after all this work of what are the very best things to eat and what this diet is about, the plant paradox, but a couple other ideas on the heart that I'm curious about. What role do you think viruses, bacteria, fungi, maybe parasites have in the classic atherosclerosis, regardless of what food they're putting in?
I think it actually has a big role.
Yeah, causing inflammation, inflaming things.
Right. What happens is that you can actually show in experimental models and even in humans. For instance, at Loma Linda, when we would do heart transplants on adults, which was usually for coronary artery disease, we actually looked at the plaques in the hearts that we took out, and the vast majority of these plaques had a pseudobacteria called mycoplasma.
Yes. Yeah.
And they were in almost every one of the specimens. And there's mycoplasma, most of us are infected. In fact, interestingly, it's the most common sexually transmitted disease that nobody knows about. So most of us carry it. So mycoplasma has absolutely been found in plaques. Many of us in cardiology believe that these plaques are actually an immune attack against bacteria and other fungal proteins in the wall of our blood vessel.
Yeah.
And that, in fact, cholesterol just happens to be an ambulance arriving at the scene.
To patch things up.
Yep.
Yeah, there's a lot of research and about the whole connection with the mouth and root canals, cavitations, and these mycoplasmas and all these things, and heart disease as well, and these infections.
Correct. In fact, years ago, one of my first projects in my new field was looking at the effect of flossing on inflammation.
Wow.
And I showed, asked people to floss every other day. The reason I chose that is because I'm a horrible flosser, and my wife flosses twice a day. She's a nut, but I found I could bring myself to floss every other day, so that's how I designed the experiment. And those people who flossed every other day dramatically lowered their inflammation markers versus the people who didn't. And my work was actually honored by the American Institute of Oral Biology as one of the significant contributions.
How can flossing cause inflammation?
No, it prevents it.
Oh, okay. Oh, I'm sorry.
Removing these bacterial colonies
of course, yeah.
from your mouth.
Well, that's good because we like to floss. It's one of our most fun things to do. Okay, then one other thing because somebody had asked about. Wild rice, these grasses, because they're more, it's more like a grass, isn't it? What do you think about these? Do they have lectins?
All the wheat, all grasses have lectins,
all grasses have
including
lectins.
Wild rice, unfortunately.
But so quickly, though, the pressure cooking.
Yeah, pressure cooking destroys all lectins except the gluten lectins.
Except the gluten.
Yep.
So that's pretty interesting information, isn't it?
And the modern pressure cooker is such a wonderful device. It's like a rice cooker. You just push a button, and about 9 minutes later, you've got a pot of beans or a pot of rice.
And they're good for you.
And they're great for you once you destroy the lectins.
So what is it? Is it just the heat or the pressure? What is it?
Yeah, with the pressure, a lectin is a protein, and it's a very tough protein to degrade with just heat, and you have to have a combination of heat and pressure to break that protein.
I'll be darned. Well, we might sell a lot of pressure cookers here coming soon.
Yeah, there's a couple of great ones out there. Instapot is very famous. Cuisinart makes one, and they're incredibly reasonable now, and it's not like your grandmother's pressure cooker. They don't explode in your kitchen.
Yeah, yeah. They used to have those little round lead things on the top.
Yeah, you remember that?
Oh, yeah. I remember my grandma had one of those things.
Yep.
Okay, so we only have maybe 10, 15 minutes left. I know you have to go to work. So just talk about, after everything that you have seen here over the years, and your conjecture, your theory, your work of the most kind of ideal diet to keep yourself from clogging up your heart?
Sure. So, number one, we're designed to eat a lot of leaves. And so the more leaves I can cram down somebody's throat, the better.
Leaves like chard, kale?
Yeah, like chard, like the brassica vegetables. We're supposed to eat flowers like broccoli and cauliflower.
Yeah, fruits.
We're supposed to eat leaves with a lot of prebiotic sugars in them, like radicchio, like Belgian endive, like artichokes, like asparagus. Believe it or not, one of the best things you can eat is okra.
Okra, good.
And most people either hate or love okra because it's slimy, but you can, in the book, The Plant Paradox, we give a recipe for okra fries that you make in the oven that have yet to make it to the dinner table because they're eaten before they ever get there.
You fry them up. Or you bake them.
Oh,
that sounds
they're
fun.
They're just great for you. So the other thing I believe is that people should view food as a vehicle to get olive oil into your mouth.
Now you're talking. So
there are beautiful studies out of Spain and Crete and Sardinia that we should probably be using a liter of olive oil per week. It's a huge amount. That's about 12 tablespoons a day. But studies out of Spain show that they took 65-year-old people and made them use a liter of olive oil per week versus the same group that had a low-fat Mediterranean diet. And at the end of 5 years, the olive oil group had preserved memory, whereas the low-fat diet group had diminished memory. But equally as important, the women in the olive oil group had 67% less breast cancer than the low-fat diet group.
Well, what do you make of that? What's up with that one?
So olive oil has these amazing plant compounds called polyphenols. And how the heck do you remember polyphenol? Well, I just have people say, poly want a phenol. Poly want a phenol? And that's how you remember it. So polyphenols, we now know, change bacteria in our gut and actually change the way our DNA is expressed. And much of my research is focused on giving people polyphenols or having them eat a polyphenol-rich diet. And we've shown that your blood vessels dilate, they become more flexible, and that you can actually measure the stickiness on the inside of blood vessels and prove that polyphenols make the inside of blood vessels slippery, literally get them lined with Teflon.
Mm-hmm. But earlier you said then, so onto the animal food, that chicken and fish have this new 5GC thing that the body likes okay.
Yeah, they have new 5AC.
New 5AC.
That's what we carry.
That's what humans carry.
Now, one of our problems with chicken, and I go into this extensively, free-range chicken, regardless of what the name says, has never gone outside. The federal government passed a law in 2007 saying that free-range chickens, by definition, can be kept in a warehouse, fed corn and soybeans, which they're not designed to eat. And if you open a door for 5 minutes every 24 hours to the outside, and the chicken has the potential to go outside, then you can label it free range. So what I ask people to do is don't eat chicken. If you're going to eat chicken, then please eat what's called pastured chicken. That means chickens are supposed to go out and eat bugs.
You got to get creative with the farmers markets, but you can find people that are doing it right.
Oh, yeah. You absolutely can.
It's a little bit more difficult. So that's a big difference. And, of course, we don't do chickens that are do drugs, right? Yeah, that's number one, right? You don't do chicken with do drugs because they're a little wacky anyway, you know, after all of that. So here's an email. This is pretty interesting. Dr. Weston Price, you've heard of Weston Price.
Absolutely.
They discovered as well that all cultures soaked and or fermented and well cooked their grains, beans, and seeds in tubers.
Very true.
Yeah, they just cooked the pants off of them. So this gets rid of that lectin thing.
Yeah, it definitely helps. In fact, fermentation, you know, we forget that, interestingly enough, there was absolutely no storage system. We didn't, you know, crawl out of our cave and said, what's for breakfast? So even when we had grains and beans, they would rot And it turns out that the rotting was extremely effective of having bacteria do the work of destroying lectins. And there's actually some very good evidence that sourdough bread is probably much safer for you because of the bacterial and the yeast fermentation of the bread destroying a lot of the lectins.
Docs are still out there trying to get people's cholesterol level down. I mean, it goes on all the time with these statins, and they're just not very good, are they, these statin drugs?
We should realize that statin drugs are a crutch. And, you know, if I break a leg, I may need to use crutches for a few weeks before the bone heals. But certainly, if I break my leg, I'm not going to use crutches the rest of my life, hopefully. So there are people who are so out of whack that even I will use statins temporarily until I get things healed. And then there really isn't a need for statins. In fact, there's a new paper just recently published looking at the effects of statins in 65-year-old people. And there was not only no benefit in longevity, but the people on the statin drugs actually had more mortality than the non-statin.
Sure, of course. But as you said, and many people have said, this main big cholesterol number of 200 or something doesn't mean anything anyway.
No, absolutely not.
What about the LDLs?
I saw a woman yesterday.
Yeah. What about the LDLs, HDLs, small particles, fat, all that stuff that people look at in their blood tests?
Yeah, so I do look at small, dense LDLs, but we now have sophisticated ways of determining whether these small, dense particles are actually oxidized or rancid or rusty.
Yeah.
And you can have actually people who have lots of these small particles that aren't rancid at all, and it actually has to do with the presence of antioxidants and polyphenols in your blood. So just looking at a LDL number or a total cholesterol number is actually not very useful at all.
What are some of the top supplements, things out of a bottle or, vitamins that you recommend to your patients to stay off the operating table?
Well, I give a whole chapter on supplements.
I bet you do, yeah.
But here's the deal. Most human beings are terribly deficient in vitamin D, and most people need 5,000 international units of vitamin D3 a day. There's no such thing as vitamin D toxicity. Dr. Hollick, the world expert on vitamin D at Boston University, has seen it once in his life. Most people are extremely deficient in fish oil. People need to realize that our brain is about 70% fat, and half of that fat is a component of fish oil. And some beautiful studies show that people who have the highest, what's called omega-3 index in their blood, have the largest brains and the largest areas of memory as they age, versus the people who have the lowest amount of fish oil, have the lowest, smallest areas of memory, and the smallest, most shrunken brains. So those are two big things. The other thing I like to get people to get is polyphenols. One of the easiest ones to get is grape seed extract. Trader Joe's has it. Costco has it. People should try to get the polyphenols in extra dark chocolate or green tea or both. Both of these are incredibly important for you. Almost all of us are deficient in magnesium. Our soils are completely depleted of magnesium. Magnesium actually helps insulin get sugar out of your bloodstream. In fact, interestingly, most of us are so deficient in magnesium that after heart surgery, we have to give people 2 grams of magnesium every 6 hours for 48 hours to get their magnesium levels up.
Wow.
Yeah, we're that deficient.
And chocolate is high in magnesium. That's good.
Yeah, chocolate. And please use extra dark chocolate.
Yeah, the real thing. Get
the real stuff. Get used to the bitterness. Yeah. As I say, more bitter, more better.
Yeah. One final thing that you didn't touch on. What is your theories on dairy? Butter, cream, even now. Let's assume, though, that we're talking around here. When we talk about dairy or butter or cream, we're talking about raw, grass-fed, no drugs, not pasteurized stuff from the Kroger.
Okay. Right.
Okay.
Well, in the plant paradox, what people have to be aware of is that there are two herds of dairy cows in the United States. Those that make casein A1,
right,
which is a really nasty lectin-like protein, and those that make casein A2. So the Holsteins are casein A1, the Guernseys and Swiss Browns are casein A2, Jersey cows are a mixture of A1 and A2, but there's a real movement in this country to switch over to casein A2 milk products. As people will see in the plant paradox, casein A1 is a major cause of diabetes and also a major cause of heart disease. The interesting thing is, heavy cream, sour cream, and cream cheese from any cow, grass-fed, is safe. But don't drink the milk or the cheeses made from casein A1 cows. If you are looking for it, for instance, in California, there's now a casein A2 milk company.
Really? That's incredible.
It's also in Colorado and starting to make inroads in the United States. Most cheeses from Italy, Switzerland, and France are from casein A2 cows.
Are they really?
Yeah. And,
so the Italians figured that out.
Yeah, that's why people who think they're lactose intolerant,
yes, sir,
can actually go over to Italy and have the gelato and say, wow, there's no lactose in this gelato because I feel fine. Well, it's not the lactose at all. It's the casein A1 that they react to in the United States.
So the Guernseys are the best guys, the Guernseys?
Yeah, the Guernseys, and then there's another cow called the Swiss Browns. The Guernseys are the best guys. Interestingly enough, the high-quality ice cream manufacturers often use Guernsey cows
because they
have more cream.
Huh.
Yeah, I learned this from becoming a fan of a lady in Columbus, Ohio, who makes Jenny's ice cream, and she only uses Guernsey cows that are grass-fed.
That's funny. That's hilarious. You know, people are going to be going to farmers markets and say, well, what kind of cows do you have for this cheese, you know?
That's what they need to do.
They need to do, right?
I mean, yep, they really do.
Yeah. Okay, one final thing. How is it possible, here's an email, that people have such good health and longevity in Italy eating all this pasta? I just don't understand.
Well,
it's an email.
Because, as I talk about in the book, studies that look at every factor in a diet have shown that the grains and pastas are actually negative factors in these diets that are overcome by the olive oil, by the vegetables, by the fish, and believe it or not, the red wine that these cultures make.
Ah, good for them.
Yeah, so these are actually, the cereal grains are actually negative aspects of this, but they're overcome by all the other good stuff.
All the good stuff they do. They certainly eat a lot of fish.
Exactly.
Yeah, over there. Well, Doc, you're great fun to talk to. Thank you. The name of the book is The Plant Paradox, right?
Yep.
The Plant Paradox, Dr. Stephen Grundy, who, you don't cut on people anymore. Well, that must be okay, right, for you? You don't miss that?
Yeah, you know, showing somebody how to take control of their own lives is a lot more fun than slicing somebody open.
Boy, you think? Yeah. And the website is, I'm right here. It is just, you got two of them, right? GrundyMD.com and also Doctor
Gundry, MD. GUNDRYMD.com.
And also drgundry.com. You have that one too. The Plant Paradox. Thanks, Doc. Appreciate you getting up early for us.
All right. Nice talking to you.
Enjoyed it. Thank you very much. Right. That was great fun, huh? Man, that was cool.